I'd like to introduce George Jacara. He's going to be giving this very uncontroversially titled talk, Fuck Mindfulness, A Marxist View of Dehumanisation in Late Capitalism. George is a long-time socialist and he's also a teacher. So I'm going to hand it over to George and then we'll have some time at the end for questions and discussion.
Thanks everybody for coming along. You'll have to excuse me, I'm going to do it if you're sitting down. I would do it standing up, but still adjusting to the need for reading glasses. So if I get too far away from any notes, I might not be able to see them. First thing, given the provocative title, I hope, one, that I don't underwhelm and that the conversation doesn't underwhelm. But two, I also wanted to begin by making a qualifying remark, I think an importantly respectful qualifying remark, which is that this talk is not about denying the importance as reprieve, as sometimes as rest, certainly as relief, and very often as distraction, the importance of such things as mindfulness or mindfulness techniques, or for that matter, any of these other things you see up here. Pretty much all those things you see up there are things that in various ways we take part in our lives to make life sometimes more tolerable, to distract ourselves from the difficulties, and even sometimes when we're lucky, to enjoy some temporary joys. Certainly for me, sports, that one, fulfills that one. Interestingly too, I should just comment on sport. There's some fantastic research work being done around the importance of sport in dealing with anxiety amongst young children in the Scandinavian education system. And certainly something that I've sort of looked into quite a bit as a little bit of an antidote to what is much more fashionable in the Australian education system, which models itself on the most backward education system in the world, the American, which is mindfulness. And my interest in this topic really comes from my work with special needs kids first and foremost. That said, we'll be talking quite a bit today too about, in fact a lot, about how mindfulness works in the workplace and in managerial culture. This is no coincidence because, in fact, over the last decade or so, management theory and education theory have not quite become one, but there is quite a fusion of those two things, and you only have to look at various things that the OECD publishes to see that through. So that was my first sort of respectful qualifying comment. We all need these things at different times in our lives. The point, though, of this talk is to try to understand the ideological space that such practices, any and all of these practices, can fill in any given historical or episodic moment. Certainly, for example, if we were sitting in Spain in the 1930s, in our line of fire would not be Smiley Mind, but probably the Catholic Church. For anyone familiar with the Spanish Civil War and all the various anti-church jokes that come out of the 30s in Spain, that was a much bigger concern for those in the progressive movement. As something more than just distraction in that particular era, but as actually fulfilling an important reactionary ideological space, or filling an important reactionary ideological space. Well, we're not in Spain in the 30s, and more, and certainly in my experience in education, we come across mindfulness, and as I said, as we do in workplace and managerial theory, we come across mindfulness as something very heavily loaded, ideological, very ideological. Indeed. It probably wouldn't be wrong to say that mindfulness practices have become a norm in managerial practices, certainly in the workplace, increasingly in schools, and sadly, increasingly in the home. And I'll come to that in a sec, and it's particularly interesting how much it is invading personal life. In fact, many companies are finding it, quote, this is quotes, it reduces stress and absenteeism, increases productivity, develops better leaders, generates more creative workplaces, enhances cognitive thinking skills, triggers more imaginative solutions, etc., etc. Pretty much all the same adjectives, verbs and nouns can be found in education theory in justifying mindfulness practices, techniques. And it's particularly frustrating, I find it particularly frustrating as an educator, of course, because you get especially special needs kids where there's now, just a plethora of diagnosis, misdiagnosis, etc., disorders, supposed disorders. And all sorts of problems, of course, all sorts of context, lead to the issues, the problems that these kids have. But in the end, we put them in a classroom and we say, well, here, spend the next half an hour looking at Smiley Mind on your phone and listening to meditation techniques or participating in a meditation technique. For those of you who haven't tried out on your phone, it's free, Smiley Mind. And we don't address what might be happening in the home, let alone, God forbid, that we might address what's happening in school itself that might be causing these issues and these anxieties and everything else. So it, certainly from an educator's point of view, it's particularly frustrating. Now, you can understand, though, why there is these sort of practices are becoming a certain sort of norm, because if we go by pretty much any sort of surveys that are being done by more or less credible organisations, stress is definitely on the rise. Now, I mean, it's probably pretty obvious to anyone who works, goes to school. I mean, you know, it's, God, in schools it's abundantly, well, not just obvious, but ridiculous in secondary schools with the pressures put on kids now compared to, say, two decades ago. You know, the homework, the intensity of that sort of work, the scoring, the standardised testing, etc., etc. But likewise, of course, at work. So if you look, a recent Medibank survey, probably less credible, but nevertheless, that found that at least 4.9 million Australians considered themselves to be overly stressed. Probably a little bit more authoritative has been that now, I think it's gone for 5 years, although I haven't seen recent results in the last year or so of the Australian Psychological Society's stress, National Stress and Wellbeing Survey. And the last stats that I have are from 2015, and they are the worst. That's after 5 years of that survey having started. According to the 2015 figures, 35% of Australians report having a significant level of distress and stress in their lives. 26% report above normal levels of anxiety symptoms. And 26% of Australians report having moderate to extremely severe levels of depression. I mean, probably most of you are probably familiar with all sorts of statistics around that, so it's not much point going through them. But you can see, hence, why things like mindfulness technique and practices, etc., and cultures can start to sort of creep in. For those of you who haven't had to go to a workplace mindfulness workshop, there's one coming up in 7 days at my workplace. I work at Swinburne University. And this, it's titled, Using Present Moment Awareness to Drive Wellbeing and Performance. In a world in which occupational stress is on the rise with links to increased absenteeism, there's that word again, accidents at work and loss of talented workers, the potential impact of regular mindfulness practices on organisational effectiveness, important to note, and worker health and wellbeing is significant, etc., etc. What are the learning objectives that this little do? More effectively manage distractions and maintain attention and focus on what? Well, what do you do at work? You work. Reduce stress and reactivity and heighten ability to remain calm under pressure. Why? I mean, you know, none of these questions are asked. I won't go through the list of these things. Of course, the same things occur when you look at mindfulness workshops and practices in schools. There's no questioning of why, you know, you should be focused on that activity. None of that is touched upon. Or why you might be stressed and anxious, which is, as I said before, not only about your life at school and what you have to do there, but importantly at home and what's going on there and so forth. What's important in this is that you can see, once you start to look at it, that it's not about, mindfulness here is not about escape. So that's interesting, because if it was about escape, you know, like a lot of these things can be in different contexts. Now, I didn't put drugs up there, by the way, but drugs should be up there too. it's not about escape. It's actually about buying in further. And fundamentally, this is why I was very intentional about the provocative title of this conversation. This is about buying in further into the activities that you're, you know, you're, whether it's work or school, that you're being, in many cases, certainly in those two cases, being forced to do, not doing largely anyway, voluntarily. So it's not just mindfulness. I mean, there's a package that comes with this. With mindfulness practices comes the growth mindset. Any of you in education would have come across this a million times. I won't get started on it, But that goes a long way too. I mean, has a long history. It's it comes with resilience, you know, all this stuff about resilience, about grit, if you want the American term. And this has a very long history. This can-do attitude goes all the way back to, if any of you've got kids, you've read the I Think I Can book, The Little Caboose, goes way back to the beginning of the 20th century, and in particular, positive psychology itself, and I'm going to come to this because positive psychology really is more or less the theoretical foundations for a lot of the mindfulness practices and so forth, despite the Buddhist monks that get thrown in. To the extent that there are theoretical underpinnings, really, of a lot of the mindfulness culture that we're now seeing, it's in positive psychology. And that goes back, despite many people in the last three decades claiming they founded it because it makes you a lot of money, it actually goes back all the way to, in particular, well, to a number of the American pragmatists who were effectively the philosophers of modern-day capitalism, and most importantly to the psychologist and philosopher William James, who, through his own mental and personal crisis, you know, elaborated a lot of this in writing and theoretically about, you know, the importance of grit, of resilience in front of adversity, etc., etc. Okay, the message in all this is pretty loud and clear, especially once you get into it, so to speak, in terms of these, you know, if you have to be part of these practices. It's basically adjust yourself. Adjust yourself to the conditions such as they are. The hidden thing there in brackets is immutable. Immutable, you know, in other words, unchanging. All you can do is decide on the spirit in which you approach those conditions. So that's your only agency. It's in relation to the spirit in which you can approach it. So you can be negative or you can be positive. You go to school, you can be negative or you can be positive. You go to work, same thing. Now, it's important to note that this is a uniquely capitalist idea. It's a uniquely capitalist idea about contentment and happiness. You cannot find it in the Greek classics. You cannot find it in Oriental philosophies. It's uniquely capitalist. If you look back, for example, and we'll talk about this in a sec, we'll talk a little bit about the differences in the ideas of contentment and happiness in previous historical epochs. But this is essentially, or very uniquely, a capitalist idea of contentment and happiness. So at this point, it's probably worth looking at Martin Seligman's work. If you're in teaching, you would have come across this guy. So this, if you want to see a photo of him, go to Geelong Grammar's, what's it called? It's not Happiness Institute. Positive Psychology Institute. Yeah, so Geelong Grammar actually makes money out of this institute. It's a big button on their website. It's a way that they can sort of sell their services in positive psychology and workshops and so forth. And there's quite a few photos in there, or there has been in the past, of various Geelong Grammar principals, teachers, etc., with Martin Seligman, who's probably the main person who sells himself as the founder of positive psychology. Let's have a little look at the sort of work that Martin Seligman does. So he's known in particular for the thing, I think, called the PERMA model of positive psychology. It stands for positive engagement, something, blah, blah. Okay, well, yeah, resilience, etc. The idea is that we all need something in our lives that entirely absorbs us into the present moment, creating a flow of blissful immersion into the task or the activity. Again, not questioning, you know, why you're doing that task or that activity. And as I said, this is something that has been practiced a lot in schooling, but probably more telling of this is where Martin Seligman and the University of Pennsylvania, I think, which is where he's based, has made the bulk of their money, and that's in implementing this program in, of all places, and I don't think this requires explaining the absurdity or paradoxical nature of it, the US Army. So in the US Army, they have sold this model to the US Army. It's currently, I think, being done by at least 1 million military personnel in the US Army. It's an online module, of course, because that's cheaper too, in positive psychology. So this is, quite amazing. So they've been doing this since 2009. It is the University of Pennsylvania, working with the United States Army's Comprehensive Soldier and Family Fitness Program to deliver resilience training programs. The purpose of these programs is to teach resilience skills in order to increase resilience, and enhance the performance of soldiers. Performance in what again? families of soldiers and the department and the various army civilians. So this is a very huge program. The module includes things such as, or the intention of the module that soldiers and other military personnel do, includes objectives such as reducing, this for soldiers, reducing anxiety through techniques for controlling intrusive thoughts and images. Creating a narrative in which the trauma is seen as a fork in the road that enhances the appreciation of paradox. Loss and gain, grief and gratitude, vulnerability and strength. So again, you know, we're talking about the military-industrial complex. We're talking about the lives of soldiers who are fundamentally traumatised by what they're called upon to do. And this is, and this is mindfulness, I suppose. So that's a little bit about positive psychology. As I said, it's quite uniquely capitalist. If you look, for example, at the notions of contentment and happiness of the Greek classics and that whole historical era, what are they? I mean, for those, the basics of Plato and Aristotle, they are the ability to contemplate, love of knowledge, that's nowhere in this mindfulness culture, avoidance of pain, certainly not in that military module, enjoyment of beauty and honour, very different notion of contentment and happiness. As I said, it's not the happiness of Oriental cultures, which put particular emphasis on social harmony and overcoming of individualism, not enhancement of the worst type of individualism. So the happiness of positive psychology is about losing, if you like, about negating whatever is left of ourselves, which is human and social, in my opinion. It's turning us into, in a sense, a full commodity, where our labour power already is. So, I mean, we are, by what we do, as alienated labourers, already partially commodities. But what's left of us, even under capitalism, of, let's call it a human soul or whatever, a social being, these sort of practices, especially when you see them in the way they work in the workplace, and I think very much in education, are about further commodifying you, further making you your own brand, et cetera, et cetera. I'll talk about that a little bit more. It's, in a sense, about letting our exchange value on the market overcome our humanity that much more further. As I said, being our own brand, which is a common terminology that's used in all sort of management speak about improving yourself as a person, most importantly as a worker, as a person as a whole. Now, it's important to say that this cultural shift, and I think there is a cultural shift, it goes back decades, really, in terms of management theory, but this cultural shift is not uncontested, but I think it is typical, especially typical of late capitalism. It's not that you don't find all this stuff, in the 30s or 40s and 50s, but the dominance of this sort of stuff, this new cultural norm, is particularly typical of late capitalism, neoliberalism, if you like. As capitalism has increasingly eroded and destroyed the old ties and institutions, this might sound familiar, it's not word for word out of the Communist Manifesto, but it could well be. As capitalism has increasingly eroded and destroyed the old ties and institutions that people once sought reprieve and consolation in, that institution even, and certainly the family, etc., and what it's done is increasingly replaced these with the cult of the individual. Certainly that's very much the ethos of the culture of neoliberalism. And I think I like to borrow a term used by the French philosopher Bourdieu, who refers to it as totalitarian individualism. It's that sort of the feeling you get in sort of modern day emphasis on the individual. So the market now is not only is... Sorry. Now, I should say, that, of course, all of this is still qualified and sometimes mitigated by political struggle. We're talking in absolutes. Where there is political struggle, there is less of this, or it's contested. Where there isn't, it leads the market inexorably into every corner of human existence. It allows the market into every corner of human existence. The market is no longer only in the shopping malls that we visit, but it creeps, or certainly has crept increasingly, into our most personal and emotional spaces. So on the one hand, well, one thing it's done is it's brought the culture of work more and more into the home. And I'm going to talk about that in a second. So this is most extreme. It's most extremely experienced by sort of the better off working class in the richer countries and mostly by the middle classes, but it seeps down into society as a whole, that bringing of culture of work into the home. And sort of the other side of the coin is it takes what, as I mentioned before, what's left of our true, to use Marx's more utopian formulation, true social selves into our workplace. And hence, you know, the glorified workplaces of today in management theory are Google, where you express yourself. So you take everything that might actually be good about you, you know, your creative thinking capacities, etc., and you take them into the workplace. And you work 15-hour days because, oh, well, you can sit on a beanbag the whole time. So it's sort of two sides of the same coin, bringing the culture of work into the home and taking what's left of our true selves that might have before had some sort of space at home or in family or in church or wherever into the workplace, creating what some people call the always-on individual, always-on worker. So this is very much harks back to Marx's formulation in the Communist Manifesto. All the old ties are broken asunder. So, to give you some examples. Now, of course, the old ties are broken asunder because of the sort of progress, in inverted commas, of capitalism. So, you know, the breakdown of the family, in inverted commas, that Marx referred to in the Communist Manifesto is much, much more evident. In contradictory ways, but it is much more evident today. I mean, if you look at, say, US statistics, I haven't found Australia, I didn't bother to look for Australian statistics, but 70% of all American children live in households where all the adults work. And that would probably be pretty comparable statistic across the rich countries. And actually, even across the sort of middle level, what used to be called third world, the more developed third world countries. And, of course, in many cases, as we know, we certainly know the figures in Australia, in the US, up to 40% of families are single mother families. Now, I mention these, what are essentially economic statistics, because they are manifestations of this breaking asunder of the old ties, and it's what allows the spaces for the market to then creep in, basically, to fill those voids. So this takes the form, most extremely, of the myriad now of personal services that are increasingly being extended to the middle classes, at least, but even to the better-off working classes. So you have, I mean, God, in America there's everything. Rent a grandma, rent a friend, rent a, you know, is everything available. Some of these take different, more less in-your-face names in Australia, but they exist. All sorts of personal services that sort of fill that void for money, of course, and bring that culture that we're talking about into the home. So what's, in a sense, the greatest innovation of the contemporary scene are those services that reach into the heart of our emotional lives, a realm that was previously at least partially shielded from the market. But now less so. So, you know, for example, in the US, things like love coaches are a big trend. So not only are we talking about online dating, but that's too complex. It might be too complex, so you might need a love coach to help you through that. Or even more ridiculous, like, hard to believe, but people are paid to be wantologists. Wantologists, as in the word want. So these are people you can pay to help you understand what you want. So, again, these are more services for the middle classes, but the culture that they bring, you know, seeps through into society. In fact, in many some of these services are not just for the middle classes. I mean, 1 in 10 couples in the US hire a wedding planner. So that's, you know, not just the middle classes. More likely, though, you'd need more money. You'd need to be middle class to hire a namologist, maybe, for example. A namologist, believe it or not, depending for different fees, depending on exactly the service you want, will help you come up with the right name for your baby so that you are less likely, for example, names that are more likely to engender leadership ability, financial reward, creativity, et cetera, et cetera. So baby planners, I mean, here it's more about, you know, more likely full baby planner, but you will get people who, you know, you hire because of all the sort of childcare needs that people do have because of, you know, the extension of work hours, et cetera, et cetera. So in some of those cases, you are talking about things that working class families are buying into. And with that, the culture. One of my favourites was, you know, you can hire, I haven't come across these in Australia, but professional party animators for teenage parties. Because anyone who's been to a teenage party, sometimes they're hard to get started. So you can hire a person that will actually come in and animate, you know, and get them going. My personal favourite, and this is really only for corporates, really, because it's very expensive, is a company in America now that's made quite a bit of a stir called Family 360. And not surprisingly, they came out, it was founded by some neoliberal managers of another corporation, but basically they saw a need and, more importantly, a profit could be made out of offering this thing where they will go into your family and audit your family. And they will look at things like, you know, what are the communication opportunities that you're missing? You know, so, for example, you're at the dinner table, they'll audit that. Did you miss out on a communication opportunity there with your teenage daughter or son, etc.? So, I mean, they're the more extreme services, but I mention all them because apart from them being entertaining, they actually give you a sense of this culture, this totalitarian individualism, so to speak, that's promoted in this, or with this cultural shift. So you see an increasing, basically an increasing commodification and a deepening reification, which is a sort of a term mostly really used in academics, but there's a, or Marxist, academic Marxist, but I find that term easier to be more easily understood in Spanish because the Spanish equivalent of that term is just thingification, so as in the word thing. So basically more and more of ourselves are expressed through things and then in reverse likewise, a deepening commodification and reification, to use that term. So we increasingly express ourselves through things, it's a long-term phenomenon, and we increasingly find meaning in things. Marx did not only show that human relations were veiled by relations between things, but rather that in the commodity economy, and this is what we see very much in exaggerated form, I think, now, social production relations inevitably take the form of things that cannot, form of things and could not be expressed except through things. Now, that's not entirely true. If it was entirely true, we wouldn't be here talking about it. But that's the tendency. Relations and emotions, etc., increasingly expressed through things. So social relations are realised through things and individual development, and this is where it fits in with what we're talking about with mindfulness, individual development becomes tied to building your personal brand. At the same time as the market invades those spaces where we previously sustained some humanity, some true self, it simultaneously withdraws those stores of humanity, as I was saying before, to invest them in productivity in the workplace. As I mentioned before, like the Google workplace, you know, the ideal new workplace where you take everything that was creative, ingenious about you, all your emotional energies, and you bring them into the workplace. You sit on your beanbag and you come up with great ideas. For who? For the company, of course. You see more and more of that now. And that is very much sort of, I suppose, one of the dominant trends in managerial theory. As one management theorist puts it, the firm must be a site for creating meaning, for shared goals, where everyone can simultaneously develop their personal autonomy and contribute to the collective project. So the language that we might have in the past used to talk about family or relationships is used to talk about workplace and what we do in the workplace. So, as some people have put it, work assumes basically like a universal presence. Trying to get some of these management quotes to you. So, yeah, work assumes almost a universal presence. One of the more sort of outlandish expressions of this is found in what's called, and has been around for well over a decade, what's known as liberation management theory. So these are management theorists who play up the fact that the best workplaces, the most efficient workplaces, are those that encourage rebellion, encourage anarchistic thoughts, encourage, you know, do whatever you like, drug taking, all sorts of things. There's quite extremes in some of this. Less extreme, more organised, probably the Google type model. But liberation management is quite a significant trend, and elements of it seep into other management theory. It's basically about injecting authenticity and other life-affirming moments into work as a central facet of our lives. So in a sense, gone is, well, it's not gone, because obviously all of this, as I said, is mitigated by what we do in our struggles, you know, in our workplace struggles and, you know, in our political struggles. But the trend is to erase the divide between work and play. And that is something that's quite distinctly characteristic of late capitalism. If you look, for example, at the sort of slogans that you would find, I'll give you an example. Slogan you would find, an actual sign you would find in a Ford factory in the 1960s would read, or did read actually, exactly this: when we are at work, we work. When that is done, only then can we play. See, that's now blurred. At least then you sort of knew this was shit, but when I get home, I'll be able to do some good stuff. Now, more and more management theory, especially for those who are engaged in a lot of intellectual work, but increasingly, and I'm going to talk about this, not just intellectual work, all sorts of white-collar working class work as well, there is a push to blur that line. And it's exactly here that some of these sort of practices of mindfulness and positive psychology fit in, because you've got to justify these things ideologically. You've got to give them an emotional framework. This also is happening, this blurring is also happening even in the most blue-collar industries, and it happens through just the simple extension of hours. Because when you're in, you know, whether it's a factory situation where you work every Saturday, extended hours to get the extra money you need to pay your mortgage, or in the construction industry, again, you've got that blurring, and it happens in a very physical sense, because you have no time to do anything nice, or you certainly have no energy to do anything nice when you get home. In white-collar work or more intellectual work, it happens in a more sort of insidious, maybe, way, arguably, anyway. You're being called upon to emotionally invest in your work in a way that just doesn't align, obviously, if we have any understanding of what capitalism is. Part of this is the growing sort of internalisation of managerial functions. So we internalise the boss to some extent. Certainly that happens a lot in intellectual work. You know, I certainly see a lot with teachers, even more so with academics. But, you know, a lot, all sorts of work where you think you're doing something either interesting or useful or whatever, you internalise more of the functions of the boss. You become, to some extent, can become your own boss. Again, all of this is mitigated by political struggle. We'll talk about this in a sec when I finish up. I've talked a little bit about liberation management. So, I mean, one term that comes up when people talk about all this, and again, sort of right-wing theorists use this term, is they start to talk about, forget, you know, sort of neoliberalism, how we might refer to the epoch we're living through, late capitalism, whatever. Instead, if you're looking at it from the positive side, point of view, i.e. from a capitalist point of view, you can call it emotional capitalism. You know, it's like all the good stuff that was once in the home, why keep it there? You know, let's bring it into the workplace and let's blur, you know, those distinctions, and it all becomes fun. It all becomes empowering. These words are used by management theorists. So it becomes fun, empowering, etc. So, of course, in all of that, there's no such thing as a bad world or a bad system or even a bad situation. There's just a bad you, you know, or a fucked up you, if you're talking about kids. And hence, again, I'll go back to why I was very intentional about the provocative title, because when you see this playing out, especially with kids, it's extremely hurtful, really, because, of course, you know, with workers, you're talking about adults who can rebel, who can set up picket lines, who can organise. That's not the case, you know, when you're talking about, you know, young kids, for example. Now, let me give you examples. I said before, this is not just white-collar industries or intellectual work. So the American Postal Service, not even a particularly modern firm, it's not Google, right? They're still working the old way. So they spent bucket loads of money on trying to implement this sort of culture internally. So they spent, as I say, a lot of money on team building exercises, et cetera, et cetera. So they'll do things like end many of their staff meetings with a compulsory singing of "We Are Family." Now, the next example I'm going to mention is more extreme. Doesn't happen much, but to me it just demonstrates the logic of this. Because, of course, you know, here the logic, mindfulness, we are family, all this. The logic, of course, is to try to basically make people feel like whatever it is that they're doing, however shitty that is, being forced to be in a school classroom where they're not learning anything, or in a workplace where they're not doing anything socially productive, that they can be happy in that context. Now, of course, you know, any psychologist worth their salt knows that the greatest moments of happiness tend to occur in childhood. So, not surprisingly, industrial psychologists have realised that, well, how about this? What if we try to replicate childhood in the workplace? So this has led to inner child therapy. So I'm going to give you an example, the most extreme I could come up with because it just highlights it. A company called Alarm One in the US, not a high-paying company, anything, just sort of security company. Part of their camaraderie exercises, you know, sort of building camaraderie exercises, includes to kick off especially intense days of sales, because it's about sales as well. They made their employees wear diapers, eat baby food, have pies thrown at them, and were spanked in case they failed to meet the desired sales quota. Crying was entirely at the discretion of workers. Now, I said that was an extreme example, but it makes sense from the point of view of that sort of psychology, because it's true. I mean, some of the greatest moments of happiness in people's lives are in childhood, so why not try to bring that inner child therapy into the workplace? There are things in between, like, for example, in London, there's a huge company that runs entirely these services based on floating tanks. Because why do Smiling Mind that? I mean, we all know from 1970s experiments with LSD that floating water tanks are probably the best sort of mindfulness experience. So this company, it's called Floatworks in London, offers this service to mostly corporate types, but that are super stressed out, where, you know, corporation pays and workers come and lie in these floating tanks for, you know, an hour or two or whatever to, you know, to achieve some inner peace and then go back to work. On a much more sort of blue-collar level, well, you know, everyone knows about Foxconn in China, the rates of suicide there. Probably less people know about the number of Buddhist monks that are used there to try to ameliorate that. There's a lot of Buddhist monks employed by the company as part of mindfulness, etc., to try to ameliorate, you know, the massive rate of suicide they've had in that company. That's on top of putting up the suicide nets, for anyone who's seen the images in Google. So I'm going to try to sort of finish up on a more, hopefully more positive note. So if there's an original sin, I suppose, to the human condition, it is what we already touched on a bit, which is the alienation of labour. You know, once we stepped out of that hunter-gatherer society, you know, more and more of what we did, you know, our labouring, becomes separate from us. You know, so our creativity, if you like, gets separated from our actual practical labouring activity, which basically starts to contribute to a market, which grows and grows, of course. You know, it's not so big a few thousand years ago. Now it's all-encompassing. So that is probably, you know, that is definitely, from a Marxist point of view, for want of a better way of putting it, the original sin of the human condition. How did we get to this factory society, though, that we're at now? Because it's a long way from there to that. Factory society is the terminology that Hart and Negri use, probably useful enough, it's a descriptive term. How did we get to a situation where product and person reach so deeply into one another, to where neoliberalism can try and convince us that our wage slavery can be fun and empowering? Well, it's very much about, I suppose, mapping this separation of our creativity from the practical labouring activity. that we do to live, to eat, etc. And whereas before, maybe like that Ford factory sign said, you know, we'd go, we'd do our labouring, get our paycheck, and then go home and do our creativity. Well, more and more of late capitalism is about trying to take that away from us as well, to bring that creativity, that emotional energy that perhaps previously we used in family or elsewhere in our relationships into the workplace. Life becomes increasingly dependent on the exchange value, basically, of our labour power. So, to use Marx's, I think you can't really have a talk without a Marx quote, formulation. This is from the German ideology, Marx. Never in any earlier period have the productive forces taken on a form so indifferent to the intercourse of individuals as individuals. The only connection which still links them with the productive forces, that is the labourer, and with their own existence, labour, has lost all semblance of self-activity and only sustains their life by stunting it. Pretty much, to me, sums up, you know, this culture we've been talking about, late capitalism. The commodification of all that is worldly, and I think if some people would have their way, all that isn't worldly. Now, this is possible, this has been happening not just because, and this is very important for our point of view politically to realise and to make a big point of, this is not possible just, or hasn't just happened because of the inexorable logic of capital. That's a big part of it, you know. It is the inexorable logic of capital for the market to creep into every corner of human existence. But social struggle, political struggle, and of course revolutions mitigates and works against that. And the ideological retreat of political movements of the working class in the last three decades has had a massive impact on the ability for this to occur, for the market to creep everywhere, for these ridiculous examples I've gone through, where we might actually come to think that work is empowering and fun. You could put it in positive terms, that without generalised rebellion and struggle, late capitalism sprouts and grows all sorts of ideas, ideology, promoting, as I said, this sort of totalitarian individualism, things like this positive psychology. Also, I should add, I didn't talk about this, a sort of vulgar techno-biologism, which is a big part of these justifications. Every one of these mindfulness practices is backed by scientific theory. Now, not all of it is incorrect, some of the research, but there's a heck of a lot of vulgar techno is an important word in it too, biologism that's influencing all this. So without struggle, these things can just roll on and roll over us in some cases. And I'll finish on this note, and I don't have time because I've gone 40 minutes, I don't want to go any longer. I would like to have talked a little bit more about the positive side of this when there is struggle involved, of course. Because I think you can fairly and confidently make the statement that there is no richer mindfulness, in the proper sense of the word, than active, organised human solidarity and struggle. And the alternative to becoming ever more deeply inserted and invested in ideas that falsify our relationship to the world, because that's what they do, they falsify our relationship to the world, is to put the problem back on the context and take it off our shoulders. The world is bad. Work is shit. Families are often dysfunctional. Schools are about control more often than learning. This is the world. It's not on our shoulders. And actually, and I'll finish on this final note, any meaningful psychology, frankly, any pretense of a scientific psychology or psychology of human personality must start from understanding social context. And there's a lot of good Marxist contributions on this. The massive struggles and revolutions against capitalism have demonstrated in practice that human solidarity and collective action engender an awareness of self hardly ever realised in our ordinary lives.